Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the Bruegel podcast. My name is Guntram Wolf, and I'm very pleased and honored to host today Charles Guttert and Manoj Pradhan, the authors of The Great Demographic Reversal, a new book, and a book that I think questions quite a bit of conventional wisdom about the future path of inflation, the future path of wages, the future path of interest rates. It predicts that there will be a demographic reversal, and as a result of that demographic reversal, there will be a rise in interest rates, a decrease in inequality, more inflation, and greater labor bargaining power. And to hear about all of this, we want to first give the word to Charles Guttert and his co-author Manoj Pradhan. I think both do not need much introduction. They are very, very eminent scholars. Charles Guttert is one of the longest serving economists from Britain, who has written numerous books. And I think as one of my colleagues said when we discussed initially, you know, a lot of his books were later on, his predictions were later on proven right. So I think it's going to be quite interesting to hear what he will say today. And of course, Manoj is also an eminent economist working in the financial markets. And we will have time to discuss with the two authors their book. And Maria de Mertzis, Bruegel's deputy director, will also join in the conversation so that we have a bit of a real discussion around this new and interesting book. With that in mind, let me give the floor to Charles to perhaps present the main ideas of his book. Charles, over to you, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Guntram. It's very glad to be here, and thank you all for attending this afternoon. My friend, the governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, described the years between 1990 and 2007 as the nice years, non-inflationary, continuous expansion, otherwise known as the Great Moderation. Now, while central bank independence and inflation targetry played a very considerable role in the improved economic outcomes during these years, it wasn't in practice all that difficult to achieve the 2% inflation target, as evidenced by the fact that nominal interest rates were on a fairly steady declining path. And after the great financial crisis, central banks were even unable to meet their inflation target, despite throwing as expansionary a monetary policy as they could at the particular problem. So some other disinflationary effect was working behind the scenes. And our view is that there were very strong disinflationary impulses from a combination of globalization and demography. In particular, globalization involved the arrival of China and Eastern Europe into the global trading system where they hadn't been before. And China's equivalent of about a quarter of the world's population, and Eastern Europe involved and the access of a large number of people. So what you got was a huge positive labor supply shock, which in fact we can show effectively doubled the effective labor supply for those who could shift their production, whether of goods or services, from high wage to low wage economies. And this had very considerable disinflationary effects, first of all by reducing the relative price of goods from year to year, and secondly, within the advanced developed economies, bringing about a shift from manufacturing, where labor had been relatively well organized and unionized, to services, where their bargaining position was much less. Now, then again, demography was improving through these years until about 2010. When the working age population increases as a proportion of the population, and itself increases very largely, this is disinflationary. It's disinflationary since you will never hire somebody if they get paid more than they produce. They're always paid less than they produce. And what's more, the workers have to save in order to put money by for their retirement. So an increase in the working population that proportionately and absolutely tends to be deflationary. In contrast, a rise in the dependency ratio tends to be inflationary because neither the young nor the old produce, and yet they have to consume. Indeed, the decline in the number of young and the proportion of young because of the falling birth rate, which has now gone on for quite some time, led to a further increase in the working population, because that and consumer durables led to a massive increase in the participation of women in the working force. On the other hand, the increased number and proportion of old is happening now and will continue even more so in future, is going to be a problem, because many of the illnesses of the old, to mention a few, dementia, Parkinson's, arthritis, mean that you cannot carry on the normal activities of daily living without care and assistance from other people, and robots cannot do it. And that means that an increasing proportion of a in future declining workforce in many of the developed economies is going to have to be shifted to looking after the old, which is socially extremely valuable, as I know full well, but economically much more so. And the greater costs in terms of pensions, medicines, and care of the old is going to have an adverse effect on public sector expenditures from now onwards, as is predicted by the Office of Budget Responsibility in the UK and the Congressional Budget Office in the US. Even before COVID struck, the predicted path of deficits and debt was fairly problematical and going to lead to sharp increases. Now, we can show that demography is turning round, and the every indication now, for political and other reasons, is that globalization is beginning to reverse, or it's waning in its power. And that since these previously disinflationary forces are going to reverse, a really rather simple argument is that the factors, the effects that they brought about, disinflation, greater inequality within countries as the work done by the lesser skilled gets shifted to Asia and Eastern Europe, and lower interest rates are all going to reverse. Now, to some extent, there are many who actually accept our position, but only say this will happen in the much longer run, because labor, its bargaining power has been so reduced that it will take a long time for the prior momentum to reverse. Our view on this is that we didn't exactly know to within 5 or 10 years when the turning point was going to come, although we were clear it was going to come. But the experience of COVID, in our view, is actually going to hasten the change around. It's going to hasten the change around because the reflationary policies that have been put in place, with the massive increases in percentage monetary growth, the massive increase in deficits, the massive increase in debts, both corporate and public sector, are going to mean that we don't think that the expansionary forces that have been put in place are capable of being reversed anytime quickly, and that this will lead, at least for some time, to much more inflationary policy events, outcomes, and then the longer term demographic and globalization forces will continue and make that go on. I have to say that our view on that is certainly far from the mainstream, and I'm going to turn over now to my colleague Manoj Pradhan to discuss some of the reasons why people disagree with us, some of the mitigants that are set out as being in place, and some of the arguments that those who disagree with our position, who believe in much lower interest rates for longer, still hold, as is the case in the majority of policymakers and indeed in most central banks. So Manoj, over to you.
Many thanks, Charles, and many thanks to all of you for hosting us here. It's a great, great pleasure to be here. I'll keep my comments to two things. One, talking about the things that we have received as pushback, and then briefly conclude. In broad terms, there are five main topics or main arguments that people use to wonder whether our thesis will be as powerful as we suggest. The first of them is the numerical advantage in demographic tailwinds that Africa, India, and some parts of South America will continue to benefit from for a very long period of time. Numerically, this is absolutely right and accurate. However, economically, there are three problems here. First is, unlike about 15 or 20 years ago, when Japan went into its demographic decline, now the entire manufacturing base of the world is going into a demographic slowdown. And that makes it very hard for Africa and India to try and compensate for. Second, just taking labor supply from these countries into the advanced economies is not politically possible. And the third thing, which we have a lot of concern about, is that these countries and these areas will do well for themselves, no doubt. But they do not have the administrative capital and therefore the ability to transform the incoming physical capital into output that can then be shipped back to the rest of the world. This simply has not been a culture of production for centuries that they can call upon like China has. Second, why not limit the benefits to the old? Well, in some senses, this has already been happening. And one of the reactions that we've seen, particularly in the advanced economies and even in Germany, is that the pre-retirement cohort of the 55 to 64-year-olds have seen this reduction in their benefits in the pension period and have increased their participation already. So that there is less we can call upon in terms of higher participation from people who are already giving much more. The other thing that impedes greater participation of the elderly is having to care after family members. In many countries, the help that is given to medical dependents is very limited and limited to only those who have severe problems in charting their daily activities. And that means a greater burden on family members who can then participate less. Fourth, technology. We depend on technology. As Charles has put it very eloquently in many of our talks, robots have an emotional quotient of zero, and that is exactly the kind of care that elderly people need, which means we need technology to displace repetitive tasks wherever they can in the rest of the economy so that we can have a relocation of labor to caring for the elderly. This is something that we are not yet seeing, but we will see much more of as time goes along. And finally, Japan. Why didn't any of this happen in Japan? We are arguing for higher inflation, higher interest rates, but Japan saw the opposite. Why is that? Well, without getting into details, simply speaking, Japan saw the rest of the world as we do. A massive historic shock to the labor supply, and corporate Japan aggressively used that story to invest abroad. Japanese labor market did most of the adjustment through hours rather than wages. And Japanese productivity actually rose much more than we are seeing in the current advanced economies. So just to wrap up very quickly, what we think is likely to happen from here is the reversal of China at a very rapid clip is likely to add to the demographic headwinds. China now becomes an inflationary force. What we try to highlight in here is that despite the monetary attention that has been given and the monetary stimulus that has been given, the underlying forces of inflation are actually real forces that will push inflation up higher. Central banks will welcome this in the first year or two, calling it a success of their average inflation targeting regimes, but then struggle to deal with it. We think that means the yield curves will rise, because the front ends will be kept anchored by central banks, but longer term interest rates will rise. And that will make asset prices harder as far as return extraction is concerned. And the combination will lead to lower within country inequality. And finally, what will change in the policy regime is that central banks who have been the best friends of finance ministers for the last 30 or 35 years will now be in conflict with them. And we think in almost every place, it is the administration that will probably win out in the battle against central banks. I'll leave it there. Back to you, Guntram. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Charles, and thank you, Manoj. These were a fascinating presentation of the core ideas of your book. And of course, you also already preempted some of the points I'm sure Maria and I wanted to raise in the Q&A. So we have to sort of double down on some of the points you raise and sort of push you a bit further on them. And Maria, if you allow, let me just kick off perhaps with one or two points, and then Maria, please also join in. I mean, I really thought of two points that I wanted to raise. I mean, one is, and you mentioned it first, which is the demographic rise of Africa and the Middle East. And you kind of dismissed it, if I understand you correctly, based on the statement that, you know, they are not so good in production and in the manufacturing sector. But what about the services sector and how the services sector in Africa will develop? And given that technology is advancing, and we know that many digital services can now seamlessly be provided from wherever in the world, it seems to me the potential for deflationary pressures in parts in the service sector will remain massive in the next 10 or 20 years, because just there's just so much labor force globally available that can do all of these services, and that labor force can be in low-wage countries such as India, but also, of course, increasingly Africa and the Middle East. And so I was wondering whether you could discuss that point a little bit further. Manoj, perhaps you want to react to that point, and then let me get Maria in, and then so that we have a bit of a, more of a conversation.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a very good point you make, and it's a lovely question with a nuance for the services sector. I don't want to be dismissive of them. What I do want to say is they will do very well. I think the path for their own growth is pretty strong and is very promising, because they will be ones who provide, as you say, a low-cost alternative to many repetitive tasks that can be performed very cheaply across their borders. Our point is threefold. First, we think that unlike China, which had, whether it's politically palatable or not, it had an economically aggressive approach to unifying regulation, to streamlining services, and providing significant subsidies to the manufacturing of goods and services. I mean, the Pearl River Delta was a heavily, heavily subsidized organization. Perhaps many would argue, just like Silicon Valley has been. The problem in the Indian economy, and particularly more in the African economies, is that either the robust democracy and the fight between the federal and the state governments, that is an ongoing part of the Indian saga, and the fact that Africa has the same population as India, but 50 different nation states, means that a coordinated, aggressive absorption of capacity, overlap between infrastructure, and the provision of a persistent, simple, level playing field across which you can get industry to thrive, that's the problem that we feel is very difficult to deliver. I think they will do extremely well in the provision of some services. In fact, India has already been absorbing very simple medical translation, looking at x-rays, looking at a few other medical services that need not be done in the advanced economies, and there'll be more of that. Our question is just whether even collectively, both India and Africa can turn into a China. That's where we think the volume that they could provide the rest of the world will probably fall short. And really, what we're looking at now, given the size of the demographic problem, is that we will probably need something like three Chinas. So it would have been great if we could take their labor force to care after the elderly and the advanced economies. But under this political regime, that is precisely what has become very, very, very difficult.
And the idea that we can ship the elderly to Africa and India, and in principle you could, but the problem is that the elderly like retaining contact with their family, and the families like retaining, and the idea that you ship granny and grandpa off to, shall we say, Nigeria, I think is not really very likely.
That's right, yeah. But so may I come into the discussion? I mean, it's fascinating, and you are really going against the stream in some ways here. I wanted to perhaps raise two points in the forms of comments, questions, whatever you like, just to understand a little bit what is going on. You have a diagnosis, and you also have a prediction. On the prediction side, my colleagues and I have been looking at, real interest rates, and what the markets believe real interest rates will do in the future. And we've looked at this view a number of times now in the past 3 years. And every time we look at this view, it becomes worse and worse in the sense that the markets believe that the interest rates in real terms will be far more negative and for far more longer time. And when I say longer time, I mean, I really mean long. It is, you know, you could say that up to 10 years, the markets from which these numbers are being derived are informative. But if you go beyond that, they'd still tell us they will remain very negative. But I don't know that these markets are really quite informative, given how illiquid they are. Nevertheless, I mean, in the euro area, we are looking at numbers of -2. And in the US, we are looking at numbers of -1. You know, real interest rates remaining quite so negative for long periods of time. They're almost like in equilibrium, they're negative. And, you know, that itself is a paradox. What does it mean to have equilibrium real interest rates that are negative? You know, what does it mean for the market for capital? And, you know, that is so, there, yeah. I think markets feel something different to what your predictions are. We're going to be in this for a very long time. It doesn't really matter whether the markets are right or wrong. I mean, who knows? But they seem to be operating as though this is what's going to happen. And that in itself is, you know, self-reinforcing in some way. But then that comes back to the diagnosis of the problem. If I go back a little bit, of course, aging, of course, globalization are too big visible shocks that are putting pressures on us of, you know, the productivity and on the interest rate in a self-reinforcing manner. But there is also the issue of digitization here. And I think that's an important part that perhaps is a little bit missing from the story so far, because, you know, there is a component of digitization which is putting an enormous downward pressure on interest rate coming from intangibles. To the extent right. that intangibles will become more and more relevant, I mean, if you look at the numbers, they are really going up, whereas gross capital formation is distinctively going down for a very long time, with the exception of the first years of China opening up, where it went a little bit up, but then the trend is very unequivocal. Digital, non-tangible capital, on the other hand, is really going up. So it's basically telling you that all the value added that we will see in the economy, or increasingly so, value added will be coming from something that is not costing as much. So there is issue of measurements there that I think we need to do better in. How do we measure this? How do we capture the productivity? Also to try and explain a little bit of the productivity paradox, but it also means that these pressures won't go away. If anything, would be reinforced.
Let's talk about those two points and have a bit more of a back and forth. Charles, do you want to take perhaps the first one on the interest rates and why are markets so wrong?
We're much more confident about inflation and nominal interest rates than we are about real interest rates. Right. Indeed, your story is not necessarily in any way at odds with what we're saying, because what we're saying is that inflation will go up, but that politicians will put pressure on central banks not to raise the short-term official interest rate because of the fragility and the debt burden, in which case real interest rates remain low or could even fall further. Now, we argue that the yield curve will rise, but in cases like the US, where mortgages are based on much longer term interest rates, there may be an aim to have yield curve control. But that actually would mean that the central bank would just have to buy even more of the public sector debt that issued, and that would put inflation even further up. So even at the long end, even if the yield curve steepens, as we believe, it's quite possible that long-term real rates could remain very low or even fall further, because it's the relationship between inflation that is rising and rates that are either held down for one reason or another that will determine real rates over the foreseeable future. So your argument that real rates may remain low is perfectly consistent with everything that we're saying.
But Charles, can I challenge you, and before we go to the second point on the intangibles and the digital, can I challenge you a little bit on from sort of the point of view of sort of Larry Summers' secular stagnation kind of hypothesis? I mean, if you believe in that kind of a world, savings are quite abundant and capital is abundant. And so as a consequence, real rates are abundant and private household savings are there and are very, very significant. And if you look at the saving numbers, and you mentioned COVID also at some stage, COVID, if anything, has increased savings massively in the household sector, allowing really for very low real rates and very low borrowing rates for the government sector. And the government sector has used that capacity. So where is the inflation pressure then at that stage going to come from? If I don't fully get why you think there would then still be inflationary pressure if there is a world of so much savings and so little investment opportunities.
Well, demography is going to reduce the personal sector savings ratio quite considerably. I think there's no doubt about that. That, I think, will happen. And not only that, one of the features about being old is you've paid off your mortgage and you don't like moving. So that there's going to be a continuing and quite considerable misallocation of housing space, unless policies change really quite dramatically. And that means that even though the rate of growth of populations is going to decline, housing investment is going to decline much less than you would otherwise think. So that within the personal sector, I don't think there's any problem. Investment will remain relatively high for housing, and housing personal sector savings will go down. It is true that investment has been held very much in the advanced developed economies, but that's quite largely because they've done their investment abroad in China through overseas FDI. And as globalization reduces, you have to bring back your production to your home country, and there are fewer workers, and the workers are asking for more money. Then you will raise investment more than you have in the past in order to maintain competitiveness and to retain profitability. Again, if you look at this from an overall world point of view, you can see one of the reasons why investment in the developed economies has been so low is because it's been just so much easier to do the investment abroad.
If I can add a little bit to that and also bring in the digital question, I think, Maria, the points you're making are very well taken. So, in fact, one of the papers I really liked some time back was Schoenholz and Cecchetti, who have calculated intangible investment, and they've kind of shown that it's almost an exact offset for the tangible investment that has been falling over the years. So effectively, what we're trying to say in here is worry about a question is that, are we running out of jobs or are we running out of workers? It can't be both, surely. There must be some space in between where we are and where exactly are we. So I think the issue is that in a lot of sectors where tasks are repetitive, where AI has been able to do a lot of things and they can be offshored, I think the task has been done to some extent. To elaborate on Charles's point, there's another lovely article that's worth reading called The Surprisingly Swift Decline of U.S. Manufacturing Employment. And that shows a collapse at the same time that China was given preferred trading rights after congressional approval in 2000. So a lot of the investment abroad has been done. A lot of the technological advances, if you listen to Satya Nadella, have probably been fast-tracked and we've got them in here. I think what changes the situation from here onwards is two things. And I'll focus on the real side because Charles has already spoken on the monetary side. First is if you look at the forced savings, and the savings are forced savings. I think the ECB research confirms a lot of that. That is because our lifestyles have been forced to change and not really out of a smooth equilibrium change, which means at whatever time we get back to a normal lifestyle, I mean, who knows where they are, I'm in London and we are back into a tier two system over here. But whenever that does happen, that pool of savings that we have is going to come back into operation. And the longer it takes, the greater will be the supply adjustment, which will then lag behind this sudden increase in demand that we will be likely to see at a time where monetary and fiscal policies are aggressively still being deployed. The difference in the deployment of monetary policy in this time and the great financial crisis is that in the last go, they were given to firms, to banks rather, which depend on a rate of return. And that's what they were chasing. This time around, they're being injected directly into households and corporates who really care much more about consumption and production decisions. So real spending has a much greater chance of rising over this period than I think we've seen in the past.
Is it possible to see a surge in demand necessary for the increased inflation you're advocating and be able to achieve our climate objectives?
It's a tough one. I think what most countries have done, it's not something that we have dealt with aggressively in the book at all, as you will have seen when you read it. I think what most countries have done is given themselves a task that they think is very far into the future. As it gets closer, I think the task will become a little bit more daunting. I think that surge in demand that we are talking about is likely to be a short burst, which actually brings inflation forward in time. It's not really something that will be such a structural boost in growth. To the contrary, what we are arguing is that demography will actually reduce overall growth as we go along and still bring about inflation because of the forces that are at play over here. So that surge in demand is something that could kickstart the story and push it into higher gear once we have a playing field that allows for some of that forced savings to be spent.
And one of the problems that we see with the massive accumulation of debt is that the nicest way to reduce the debt ratios is to grow out of it. But the declining working population means that we are very unlikely to do that, because Japan has actually got the highest rate of growth of increases in productivity per worker. It's just that the number of workers has been going down. And if the number of workers in so many other countries, especially including the European ones, and the forecast for the working age population in countries like Germany and Italy, and indeed most of them, are fairly dire. In order to get anything like a recovery in growth, there's going to have to be a productivity miracle. Now, we think the productivity in the European countries and the US will go up, because the shortage of labor will force more investment and will bring about higher productivity. But it's not going to be enough unless there is a miracle to offset the declining working population.
We are coming close to the end of the podcast recording, but Charles, let me perhaps shoot one last quick question at you, given the picture that you're painting. Would you advocate that the ECB, the European Central Bank, takes a more restrictive monetary policy stance already now in order to prevent an eventual surge in inflation and, you know, send a signal that will not accept fiscal dominance?
No, I'm certain I would not be more restrictive at present. In policy terms, my view is that actually, given the massive increase in debt, the slowdown that we see are likely in growth, that probably the optimal outcome is for a somewhat faster increase in inflation anyhow. We think that inflation running at an average of, say, 4 to 5% over the next couple of decades is probably inevitable and even may well be the most desirable outcome. The difficulty for central banks and the politicians behind them is going to be to limit the inflation to a somewhat higher but not explosive rate of inflation. The danger, I think, in the longer term future is that inflation gets out of hand. We have to prevent that, but we do not have to prevent inflation running at about 4 or 5% per annum. And given the dire situation that we are going to be in from now on, I think that may well be about as good as we can get.
Wonderful. I think we could continue, of course, on this point and on many other points forever. But I think for the purposes of the podcast, that is it for the moment. For all those of you who listen to this podcast, please go to our website, www.bruegel.org, where you find more information, and also Google or find out about the book of Charles Goodhart and Manoj Pradhan, and have a look at the book for more details. And let me conclude by thanking you, Charles, you, Manoj, and Maria, for this great conversation for the podcast. Until next time, thank you.